Hello, everyone, and welcome to Headwise, the videocast and podcast of the National Headache Foundation. I'm Dr. Lindsay Weitzel. I am the founder of Migraine Nation, and I have a history of chronic and daily migraine that began at the age of 4. Today is our monthly headache news episode with Dr. Tim Smith. Hello, Dr. Smith. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on again. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for being here. Yep. Dr. Smith has extensive experience in migraine clinical trials as the CEO of Study Metrics Research. He is also a board member of the National Headache Foundation. We're very lucky to have him here to give us some insight into the latest migraine and headache medical news. We're going to start with a new exercise study. One group set out to look at what types of exercise were best for people with migraine. What did they uncover, Dr. Smith?
Yeah, so this was an interesting little study. Basically, we always talk about exercise being good for healthy living, healthy lifestyle. Things are good for our migraine patients. Some of our migraine patients struggle with being able to exercise, especially if their head pain is bad. But this group looked at the types of exercise engaged in and had some sort of interesting findings. If they looked at headache frequency, this was most likely to be improved by aerobic exercise. So walking or cycling or jogging, as the case may be, something that more vigorous aerobic exercise gets your heart rate up, gets you breathing quick or more rapidly. Mm-hmm. The aerobic exercise also decreased the duration. So frequency and duration were best managed by aerobic exercise. But if you wanted to look at intensity of attacks, it was a little different, and that only yoga of the types of exercise looked at actually decreased the intensity of the headache. So people can take it for what it's worth. Think about what you do with your exercise. But I would just argue that those folks that can't engage in a heavy aerobic exercise could certainly do a version of yoga and still reap benefits, especially as it pertains to intensity.
Okay. We'll move on to our next study. There has been some question as to whether certain monoclonal antibodies against CGRP might have the side effect of increasing blood pressure. One study out this month looked at arenumab or Aimovig and its effect on blood pressure. Let's talk about the results of this particular study.
Sure. So basically this study is, we know that arenumab, the brand name Aimovig in the U.S., has been sort of, I wouldn't say singled out, but they wound up with warning in their package label regarding elevated blood pressure. And the take home is clinical people should and patients should monitor blood pressure on patients who are on arenumab. And this study was a retrospective trial that had done at a headache clinic using observational data. And the interesting sort of numbers that we take from this is that 21% of patients had hypertension at baseline. So these were hypertensive patients at baseline. But during the observation period in the study, 23.3% had worsening of their hypertension. And these were patients on arenumab or on Aimovig. Mm-hmm. So on face value, that sounds like a obviously not a positive thing,
right?
Especially for arenumab.
This study have any limitations?
Well, yeah, I think that's the important point to make here is that, so we do have this observation over time of worsening hypertension presentations, but there was no comparison in this. This was a within group comparison, start to finish, of how many people evolved into having problems with having hypertension presentations, elevated blood pressure presentations. And they argue that there should be increased surveillance of blood pressure on patients who are on arenumab. But what's missing on this is, what about people who weren't on arenumab? What about the other monoclonals? What about people who weren't on a CGRP blocker at all? Were there differences in those groups? And this is sort of a difference within the group, which may be important, but it's not an indictment or any kind of conclusive thing. So it's an observational study. We like those, but we take them in the context of which they were performed and sort of with their limitations. I might even argue that we check blood pressures on everybody anyway, and I I would check them on my other monoclonal patients as well, just to make sure we're not missing something. If it's the kind of thing, what you look for, you find. So if you're looking for blood pressure in orenumab patients, not saying there's not an issue. I'm just saying that if that's what you're looking for, you're likely to find it. Right. So anyway.
Okay. Well, the next study that we're going to talk about, I thought was actually fun to read. I'm not sure I can make any sense of the results, but it was interesting. As we know, migraine is often unilateral or occurs on one side of the head. This research group aimed to determine if there were any differences between people whose migraine pain occurred mostly on the left or right side. What did they find?
Yeah, so this study was kind of interesting, fascinating to me for a couple of reasons. I mean, I think is there a difference between the sidedness of headaches in terms of patients' lives? We know that a unilateral aspect to headache is one of the diagnostic criteria for migraine. However, not all people have just a one-sided headache, and many times their migraine will switch sides, and we've mm-hmm. seen that happen lots of times before. But this study, what fascinated me was this was a longitudinal study. It was based on intake questionnaires at a headache clinic, and they gathered data for 20 years. I mean, 20 years. That this is a huge undertaking, and what a database too to look at. Yeah. Right. So I expect we're going to continue to see other analyses that come out of this. But when they just looked at the strict sidedness of the headache, and what they did is they eliminated all the people that had a global headache or wishy-washy headache that switched sides. It was people that if they declared that they had a sidedness, and what they had to do is they didn't ask them, do you have one-sided headaches? Strict. Yeah, they said they gave them a little figure of a little cartoon of a head and said, draw on the head or color in the spot where your headache occurs. And mm-hmm. they only included people in the study who identified only one side. If they went across both sides of the head, they were not included in the study. And if they had more than one type of headache, both types of headache had to be on the same side for them to qualify. So they're really focusing on patients who are distinctly left, patients who are distinctly right. And when they looked at it, there were almost 49% of the people had left-sided and just over 51% had right-sided. There was no in-betweens because they excluded those. And when they looked at a lot of different characteristics for these migraine patients' lives, there was separation on two parameters that they measured. And one was the severity of the migraine attacks, and the folks with the left-sided migraine had worse migraine severity. Mm-hmm. And when they looked at total headache days of any type, there were more total headache days on the patients with the left-sided migraines as compared to the right-sided. So I think that's pretty interesting. I can't for the life of me tell you why, and I don't think the authors know for sure either, that this separated, but it's not good news for lefties, I guess. Yeah. not left-handed people, but left-sided migraine patients. And this was an important study. It's over 6,500 people in there. So this is not just like a small study where you could have a couple of outliers that really determine the outcome of the study.
Right.
So fascinating stuff. I hope that prompts some researchers somewhere to try to help us find out why the issue is what it is, but pretty interesting. It's kind of fun to think about, as you pointed out, but, for some people, it might be sort of frustrating, I guess, but
yeah, I'm impressed that they went to that much trouble
to
find that out. So it is interesting. I'm curious to see if anything ever comes of that. So we're going to move on to a study on caffeine and migraine, which seems to be a very popular topic lately. We covered a study on this last month, too. Now we have another one that's been published. Both studies seem to be debunking some of our traditional thoughts about caffeine and migraine. What did the latest group find?
Basically, when they looked at the range of caffeine users from chronic, habitual, higher volume, everyday users, all the way down to people who never drink a drop of caffeine, there was actually no difference. Kind of music to my ears since I'm a higher end to caffeine, and I've always done it with a little bit of guilt.
But
this is another study that shows that the caffeine use as a migraine risk factor or trigger or causal agent is somewhat overblown. I will put in the disclaimer that our patients, our viewership, people that listen to this, and they know their headaches are worse with caffeine. I don't think this changes your personal experience. So I'm not trying to debunk what you've observed in your own life. If caffeine makes your headaches worse, by all means, do what's right for you. But from a statistical standpoint, for looking at large populations of patients with varying degrees of use of caffeine, there's not much difference in terms of migraine disability and frequency, et cetera.
All right. Well, that's good news for those of us that love our coffee. We've got two more studies to report on. Another study out this month was on the relationship between migraine, photophobia, and sleep quality. Everyone knows that people with migraine often don't sleep well. I think this study was awesome because we all know light exposure has an effect on circadian rhythm. And also, I think that we just all wish we understood why we aren't great sleepers. So what did this study find?
That's interesting. So this is the second migraine characteristic. So this is photophobia as part of the migraine diagnostic criteria. So it's a very recognizable, pretty unique to migraine or other headache types, may or may not. But for migraine, this is a really significant symptom for many of our patients. In lots of our studies, we look at when we ask patients, what's your number one non-pain symptom? And photophobia is right at the top of the list. So this is, it affects a lot of our patients. And what these researchers did is they looked at presence or absence of photophobia as a predictor of sleep disturbance. And so to cut to the chase, basically our patients that have the more photophobia, the more light sensitivity you have, the more likely your chances are that you're going to be have poor sleep, difficulty initiating sleep, and difficulty staying asleep. So it's an interesting finding. And I think the even more interesting sort of food for thought, and you alluded to it, is our circadian rhythms. So the authors went on to sort of hypothesize or propose that part of what could be going on here is that our patients with migraine with photophobia or light sensitivity are much more likely to seek out a dark place even during the day and during the daytime. And surveys have shown upwards of 80%, 85% of patients with photophobia will say they reliably seek a darker environment as a reliable way of helping them to cope with their migraine symptoms. And the authors said that a significant departure from light sources can sort of change the biological imprint on the brains of people who don't have as much daylight exposure, or they may have light exposures at varying times through the day, and they sort of get out of the circadian rhythms that are normal: daylight, light, nighttime, dark. And these people are spending much of their daylight hours in the dark, and it may sort of scramble up some of the brain's ability to have normal sleep architecture. And so that the brain doesn't go through its normal cycles of sleep. And so people can have more difficulty falling asleep and more difficulty staying asleep, maybe not just associated with migraine, because we always talk about sleep disturbance. We know that's common in migraine patients.
Right.
We always hypothesize that it's just because of that sensitive, sensitizable, alerted, vigilant brain that we have that makes it hard to fall asleep. It makes us wake up to the least number of noises. And then once you're awake, you can't fall back to sleep. It's a story we hear time and time and time again. And so the interesting correlation is that maybe it's not that necessarily that sensitive brain. I mean, obviously there's the likelihood that that is involved, but it could be that the disturbance and the circadian rhythms of people who can consistently and frequently seek shelter from light sources throughout their day-to-day lives may kind of mess up their circadian rhythms and may mess up their sleep cycles. So
yeah,
it's an interesting phenomenon. It totally makes sense.
I love this study because I can't say that that had really occurred to me that much as someone that walks around wearing sunglasses every time I go outside. And I really do kind of stay away from most light. So I thought that that was just a great idea. So I'm glad we got to report on that one. We do have one more study. Last but not least, we have a pediatric headache study. We see so few studies in kids. I'd like to report all the pediatric headache studies that we can find. This one was looking at kids with unremitting headache to see if there were any predictive characteristics for improvement. What did they find that predicted that unremitting headache might actually stop in some of these kids?
So the unremitting or unrelenting or persistent headache, these are the kids that just, they can't catch a break. They're always fighting headache or worried about the next one or trying to recover from one and not fully getting rid of it. We know the story. And what they did is these researchers looked at those kids, looked at children as they began the school year. They categorized them as unremitting, chronic, persistent. I guess it's hard for children to be chronic necessarily, but they've had unrelenting, unremitting migraine for months and they're heading into the school year. And they did a series of questionnaires at the beginning of the school year, and they also did them at the end of the school year. And the ones they did at the first part of the school year, they used to see retrospectively if they could find some characteristics that would predict or would be associated with children who were possibly going to remit or their headaches were going to go away or become less relentless during the course of the school year. And lo and behold, they did have children that did, and they had children that did not, that continued to have unrelenting headache all through the school year. And so they separated those to be the two study groups, but they naturally separated themselves. And then they could look at those questionnaire scores at the beginning of the study and see if there was a difference between our demographics or other differences between the populations. They could look at them and see if there was a difference in any of those characteristics. And what they saw is that these children patients that had unrelenting migraine at the beginning of the school year, if they're the ones with the higher pain scores, the ones that had comorbid anxiety, the ones that had comorbid depression, and the female patients were more likely to continue to be unrelenting. The male patients and the ones with the lower initial pain scores, the ones who did not have anxiety or depression at the beginning, they were the ones they typically turned out to be. It didn't guarantee that they would remit or stop having their headaches or have a much more normal pattern of headaches, but there was a strong association. And then lastly, at the end of the study, they looked at the scores of patients between the two groups. And some of this is not surprising, but the remitted population, the patients whose headaches did either stop or went into a more normal, manageable, intermittent migraine pattern, those kids were less likely to have, they were less likely to have mood disorders. They were more likely to have satisfaction with their school experience. They had a better sleep too. So here's a sleep issue again. So they fell asleep better. They stayed asleep longer. They were less anxious. They had less depression. Their depression scores went down if they were high from the beginning. And the other group, the unremitted group that continued to have the headache all the way through the school year in the same fashion, they were less likely to have an acceptable school experience. They had worse quality of life. They had more comorbid mental health issues and poorer sleep. So it's kind of interesting to follow those cohorts. You're starting prospectively, sort of agnostically. You don't know how it's going to turn out. You do the same assessments on those kids at the beginning of the year. You do the same assessments at the end of the year, and they almost stratified themselves into these groups. So if we could use some of those learnings to help understand which kids were at high risk at the beginning of the year, you could have a more sensitive awareness of that possibility that these kids are going to struggle. You could direct more educational resources to them. If you have mental health resources available at the school, then you would potentially try to prioritize and give them the full benefit of that a little more than the others. Not that you would deprive of the others if they have bona fide issues, but
yeah.
you know, all thing else, everything else being equal, it, you,
right.
you could use these data to support management concerns like that.
Right. Right. If nothing else, it gives me hope for, yeah, I didn't do so great. I stayed daily unremitting, but my son, who's currently daily, it gives me some hope that he'll get better because he's male, yeah, et cetera. So anything that we can learn about these kids because they struggle so much is just wonderful because there's so few studies done in them. And the more we can do, the better. So I hope that some parents out there learned a little something from that study. So thank you so much for being with us again today, Dr. Smith. And thank you everyone for joining us on this month's episode of Headwise News. Join us again next week for Headwise. Bye-bye.